Welcome to Switchblade Sisters, where women get together to slice and dice our favorite action and genre films. I'm film critic April Wolf. Every week, I invite a new female filmmaker on, a writer, director, actor, producer, and we talk in depth about a fave genre film of theirs, maybe one that influenced their own work. And today, I'm real excited to have writer and director Demaine Davis with me. Hello, Demaine.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Hi. She sounds so shy. She's not. Let me give you a little bit of a rundown on Demaine's work and life. Demaine wrote and directed her first independent feature film in an attempt to curb violence in her community of Boston. Black and White and Red All Over was a film, and it premiered in competition at the Sundance Film Festival, where the late Roger Ebert, RIP, called it remarkable, and Amy Tobin named it one of the most original American indies of 1997. Demaine was asked then to attend the Sundance Filmmakers Lab, both the writing and directing workshops, with her script, Lift. The script was born from Demaine's personal experience with boosters who sell hot designer clothes. She left the labs with 60 pages of notes and an introduction to the producers who would fund and produce her second feature. So Lift stars Kerry Washington in her first solo film as a professional shoplifter who tries to mend her fractured mother with stolen goods. It garnered Asian TV rights through the Sundance NHK Filmmakers Award, premiered in dramatic competition, was nominated for two Film Independent Spirit Awards, including a Best Actress nomination for Kerry Washington, was purchased by the Showtime Network, and is currently streaming on Amazon. In the meantime, Demaine was directing commercials and freelance copywriting before she went to work directing two episodes of Queen Sugar for Ava DuVernay on the second season. And on season three of the show, she joined the staff as a producing director. Demaine has since directed on the second season of For the People, which premieres March 7th, The Red Line, a limited series coming to CBS in April, and she just wrapped on How to Get Away with Murder.
Yeah.
Pretty diverse projects, I would say.
Yeah.
What's good?
Yeah,
keeps you busy.
Man. Yeah, man. Listen, I'm a product of hashtag the Ava effect.
Ooh. So, as many of our guests have
isn't
been
incredible,
which is wonderful. Everyone coming up at the same time. It's beautiful.
Yeah.
Shine theory.
Yeah.
So, Demaine, the movie that you chose to talk today about is a great film, a cult film, a musical,
a fantasy.
It is The Wiz.
The Wiz, yeah.
Can you tell me a little bit about why you chose that film to talk about?
I was thinking about what really affected me being young and sort of like story and narrative. And, you know, it was fun to go back and rewatch it because I hadn't seen the whole thing in a really long time.
Sure.
And now that our brains are wired a lot differently, there's stuff like, wow, we're on that wide for like 12 hours. But, you know,
yeah.
It's very different.
Yeah.
But still, so many themes ring true about home and about believing in yourself. And, you know, it's sort of more of like a Joseph Campbell kind of situation that I think has just always stuck with me. I was a big fan of the play, even though I didn't see it. My sister, Denise Marshall, and I shared a room growing up, and so I had access to all of her books, which is why I'm a really avid reader, and all of her albums.
Mm-hmm.
And The Wiz was one of those albums, the Broadway cast album.
Yeah.
And I remember looking at the cover and like kind of falling in love with that, and she would play the album and I would play the album. That was Stephanie Mills on Broadway.
Yep.
And, you know, Stephanie Mills, What You're Gonna Do With My Love and Stephanie Mills. And then it became a film in 78. And I made note, like, the other films that came out in 78, Midnight Express, mm-hmm. Death on a Nile, Deer Hunter, Superman, Animal House, Invasion of the Body Snatchers, Boys from Brazil, Foul Play, Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. I think the only other one of those films I saw in a theater was Superman.
Mm-hmm.
I saw The Wiz in a theater, and it was the only one that had people who looked like me.
Yeah.
And so it just, that fantasy that you talked about, it just sort of allowed me to dream and believe, and it took me completely away because it felt real, because they were like on location, but the sets were so fantastical.
Mm-hmm.
So it just stuck with me. So I thought I would talk about
There's a lot of stuff that we're going to get into that you mentioned. For those of you who haven't seen The Wiz, today's episode will give you some spoilers, but that shouldn't stop you from listening before you watch. As always, my motto is that it's not what happens, but how it happens that makes a movie worth watching. Still, if you would like to pause and watch The Wiz first, now's your chance. Let's introduce The Wiz with a, I mean, writing these synopses sometimes are very interesting. Like, how do I sum this up?
Yeah.
Okay. Written by Joel Schumacher and directed by Sidney Lumet for release in 1978, The Wiz stars the one and only Diana Ross as Dorothy Gale, a kindergarten teacher who lives with her Aunt Em and Uncle Henry. It's a snowy Thanksgiving in New York, and the timid Dorothy runs out into a blizzard to find her dog Toto, but is transported to another world. Her arrival knocks down a sign that crushes a wicked witch, and Dorothy gets her magical shoes. Graffiti people, who've been trapped on the walls, come out and thank Dorothy in song for setting them free.
We just want to lay a little thanks on you.
What? You know, heavy on the gratitude department.
Gratitude for what?
For curling the curse.
For leveling the leech.
For killing our oppressor.
Then Dorothy finds she must follow the yellow brick road to get help to go home. But all the taxis take off the second that she tries to catch one. She begins walking and comes across the Scarecrow, played by Michael Jackson. Scarecrow is being taunted by a bunch of birdmen, but Dorothy scares them off, and the two work together to find the beginning of the yellow brick road.
Come on then, ease on down.
Their trip is joyful until they travel over a bridge into a Coney Island type of park, where they meet the Tin Man, played by Nipsey Russell. They free the Tin Man from a heavy statue and continue on their way until they reach the New York Public Library and notice that one of the lions out front is watching them. Then the Cowardly Lion, played by Ted Ross, breaks out from the statue that he was in and tries to scare them, but Toto sets him afright. All four are in need of something, and Dorothy tells them that maybe the Wiz can help them all when they get to the Emerald City.
Maybe the Wiz could give you some courage.
It's a good idea.
Capital suggestion. Capital. He's gonna get me a heart.
And me some brains.
But they encounter monsters in the subway, and later poppy girls who try to put the gang to sleep for forever, delaying their quest. When they finally arrive, the citizens of the Emerald City perform some colorful, funky dance numbers, and Dorothy and the gang meet the Wiz, who appears as a fire-breathing head. The Wiz will help them if they kill the Wicked Witch of the West, who runs a sweatshop. A literal sweatshop. The witch, however, hears about it and sends monkeys to catch them. There's a battle of will in the sweatshop, but Dorothy and the gang prevail and head off to reap their rewards. They find, however, the Wiz is just a dude, Richard Pryor, and he can't help. Fortunately, Glinda the Good Witch comes and helps them find the power in themselves that they already had to get everything they wanted.
Believe in yourself!
Okay.
All right.
Let's get into some nitty gritty. Okay, so I feel like we got to cover that John Badham was originally hired before Sidney Lumet.
Oh, I didn't know that.
So he was going to be directing this, and the reason that he quit was because he really wanted Stephanie Mills from Broadway.
From the Broadway.
But
yeah.
Diana Ross fought so hard to get this role, and John Badham didn't think that he could make it work with a 33-year-old woman. And so he was like, oh, I'd have to change the story. It wouldn't make sense. It's too infantile, you know, for this character, blah, blah. And, you know, he just didn't see it working. And so he left. Sidney Lumet.
Dog Day Afternoon, 12 Angry Men.
Exactly.
Huge fan of his work.
And Sidney Lumet has a theater background. And that became very helpful. And I think that was one of the reasons, aside from his, I think, then mother-in-law being in the film.
What?
Oh, my God. Oh, God. What is her name? She's like a legend.
Lena Horne?
Lena Horne.
Lena Horne is his mother-in-law?
Was his mother-in-law
for a short
time, yeah. He had married Lena Horne's daughter.
Oh, you're schooling me. I'm looking all this up after.
Okay. She's literally taking notes. You can't see it, but she just pulled a pen out of her hair to take some notes.
Wow. Wow. All right. Married to... Wow. All right.
So, I mean, that helped him, you know, come together with the cast.
And, sure.
But I mean, I'm curious. I would love to talk about, you know, finding the right projects and the things that kind of speak to you. Because Sidney Lumet said that 7 years prior, they had come to him with this idea of putting the Wiz in film. And he was like, bad fucking idea. This is a bad idea. Like, I can't imagine why anyone would do this. And then 7 years after that, later, he's just like, this is great. All black cast. Let's do it.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it's kind of nuts. And Joel Schumacher, who I believe he also penned the script for Sparkle, which came out in 76. So that's before this.
Mm-hmm.
And then Diana Ross had already done Lady Sings the Blues and Mahogany.
Yep.
And I never thought of her as being 30 in that. I mean, I feel like she played it really well.
Kind of like a timid, you know. You know, childlike in a sense.
Yeah, yeah. Just not really herself yet.
Yeah.
Like not fully, you know. My niece is 25 and, you know, she has a voice that she talks in. But then, like, when she's totally comfortable and just chilling out, her voice is lower.
Yeah.
And so I'm like, oh, that's the voice that you'll ultimately have later.
Yes.
Once you're like, oh, no, I'm good here. No, this is how I talk now.
Yes.
So sort of that kind of thing. That's crazy. I didn't know that whole backstory. I didn't have enough time to look up all that stuff. I was just spending a lot of time rewatching and singing.
That's all you're supposed to do. Yeah, I want to. I mean, you've mentioned the wide shots a couple of times, and that is something that I noticed a lot here. You know, we earlier, you know, in Switchblade Sisters, we went over the movie All That Jazz, for instance, right?
Mm.
And I'm thinking about the way that is shot versus the way that The Wiz is shot. And there's, you know, some similarities in the kind of like, you know, you're committing a stage musical to screen and the choices that are made. And I, you know, like, obviously Fosse's going to do more kind of close-ups and weird stuff, whereas Sidney Lumet is just, he's like back. He's up on a crane and he's just kind of watching the whole thing in a wide.
Yeah.
And I'm just curious, you know, why might you do that? Why might a director, you know, like let something unfold as opposed to kind of putting their own thing?
Yeah. I mean, for me, thinking about the way that things are shot now and how they feel now, it's kind of cool because it's evidence. Like, wow, that's all real.
Mm-hmm.
Like, oh my God, every one of those people, they're dancing and everyone's on time. You know, when they get to Oz and those people are walking around and, you know, you've got to be bold in gold, which, by the way, I'm from Boston and like, I had never seen that many black people assembled before in my life, the exception of like the Kite Festival, which is like a big thing in Boston. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So like, or, you know, like, you know, the Jamaican Festival or something like that. So I was like, wow, look at all those people and they're all black and they're all dressed up. This is awesome. And so the idea that you're realizing that like that's a real, it feels more like a real place. And I guess you could have, you know, gone in more and seen more details or what was that hairstyle like, what was that makeup like, but you would have lost the fact that like, oh, this is like a real world. Like you can see in the background in some shots, like there's city lights. And I'm like, where's that shot? I just want to deep dive and figure that out. I think it was kind of like evidence and maybe a bit of an homage to the play to sort of like stand back from it. And I think, also, there were times when Lady Diana was sort of Miss Ross was sort of back from it, and then you know maybe if I'd redone it, and sure, I'll remake The Wiz, give it to me, I'll do it.
I hope someone's listening. I would love to see a remake of The Wiz.
Oh, dude, I got it. I got a cast. I got everything all set. That maybe you would get a little bit closer, but as I'm watching it, I'm like, if I had gone in there and done all, like, sure, I could have put the camera a little this and this, but I would have probably mixed it half and half.
Yeah, yeah.
But I still would have wanted wide so you could literally say, oh, wow, they're really in a warehouse. There are really 300 people who are all on cue dancing. The when they get to the Emerald City, you can see in the background there are people who aren't going around the big Oz statue who are kind of like spectators, and they're chilling and the wind's blowing and they're a little cold, but they're kind of dancing, you know, and it's just like, oh, that's real. Like, so this is a real destination.
So we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, I'm going to talk a little bit with Demaine about the experience of, you know, learning from television and applying those skills to some film stuff, which is something that Sidney Lumet did in his career. Okay, we'll be right back.
Is there a dog in a car at a bar on the street? I'm Allegra Ringo, a small dog owner. My dog Pistachio howls when she's excited.
And I'm Renee Culvert, a big dog owner. My dog Tugboat tips over when he's sleepy.
And we co-host a podcast called Can I Pet Your Dog that airs every Tuesday. We bring you all things dog.
Yes, dog news, dog tech, dogs we met this week. We also have pretty famous guests on, but Legs, we're not going to let them talk about their projects.
No.
Just want to hear about those dogs.
We don't want to hear about your stuff, only your dogs. So join us every Tuesday on Max Fun.
Welcome back to Switchblade Sisters. I'm April Wolf, and I'm joined today by Demaine Davis, and we're talking about The Wiz. So, Sidney Lumet, he says essentially that he had a training ground in television in the 1950s, mm-hmm. and that is the thing that really helped make him a great film director. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's something that a lot of directors had. You know, Robert Altman also was directing a lot of TV before he went into film. And the way that Lumet describes it is that it has a lot to do with learning more about the technical side of filmmaking. And perhaps TV is different now than when it was when he was making TV. But I was very curious about that, and him saying that there's, you know, he learned so much about how to work with a cinematographer. For instance, he was saying that you have to know your equipment so well as a film director, because otherwise people will take the directing things away from you. He said, luckily the laws of optics are constant. A 35 millimeter lens, and this is coming from translating television to film, a 35 millimeter lens does exactly the same thing on a TV or a movie camera. Mm. Sight lines, depths of focus are identical. To me, doing a picture, there's one question to which you can't leave yourself vulnerable. How do we do that? Or else they are doing their picture for you. The technicians. Do you want to work with crews who are as good or better than I am, whose knowledge matches and exceeds mine? That way we both make incredible valid demands on each other. Hmm. Okay. So how do you feel that statement? True, false, some truth, some falseness?
I mean, some truth, some falseness. I'm sure it was different back then. For me, the differences and the thing that I'll apply the next time I make a film are the pressure of time, mm-hmm. and the pressure of, you know, you're expected to shoot a certain amount of pages in one day.
Sure.
And so you really, you know, Queen Sugar, it's two takes. You have two takes and that's it. And most shows I've been on, it's two takes, unless there's a technical issue or, you know, an actor requests another or some giant thing happens or whatever.
Sure, yeah.
So it's the idea that you have to be present and you have to be ready and you have to have it in your head already. And then you have to capture it.
Mm-hmm.
But you're also coming in, I don't know, like if he did a stretch of episodes of one particular show or not. So he had, you know, a little bit more of, was grounded in that particular show.
Yeah, I think he did, you know, like three of one here, three of the,
okay.
like, yeah, he had some stretches.
Yeah, so that's a little different. But this is, I look at it as I'm a guest.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm coming into an environment where everybody knows what they're doing. Everyone's at the top of their game. And I'm just sort of kind of gently guiding it based on, you know, intent that I received from the intel from the writer,
mm-hmm.
And the showrunner, and then based on me watching the show and thinking, oh, what do I think about this character, or what would I like to see here that I haven't seen? But all through, again, through the lens of intent and the lens of what does this character want, what's trying to happen here, you know,
mm-hmm.
so we're not going to shoot the whole thing with a drone. Like, that doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
So
bring the drone.
Yeah.
I mean, how do you like the technical side of stuff? Like he talks a lot in interviews. I mean, this is just an interview that he was doing with New York Times for The Wiz is a lot of where I got that from. And, you know, he's talking about what did he say? The key word is lens. Oh, sure, I know all of it. Lens values, lights, film stock, audio transfers, optical negatives. I have to. That's movie making. I don't understand directors who don't. Take camera cranes, which is what the last interruption concerned, because someone interrupted their interview. There's the Chapman Nike. Then there's the Chapman Titan with a 10-foot boom extension. Gas and electric motors, big pneumatic tires versus the Nike's tracks. Only 8 Titans in the world, and you have to reserve them months in advance. Sure, the cost's huge, but because I know why I need the Titan for the Emerald City sequence and when I need the silent electric motor for it.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
that's, I mean... there's some, I always shy away from, like, I think that making a director know everything about technical things, you know, bars a lot of people from coming into being a director.
Yeah.
Because not everyone has access to that stuff to even learn the really nitty gritty technical side of it.
Yeah.
But, you know, I can see his point of just knowing, you know, like, well, I need a very quiet crane for this.
Sure.
shot.
Yeah. I mean, like, that's something that I would ask in the concept meeting. You know what I mean? So
I mean, how do you run like a concept meeting? Like where what's the process for something like that?
So you have the script and you're basically just talking about the concept of it, and you have all your department heads and you're going through, and maybe you're saying something like, you know, who picks the clothes for the, and they might say, oh, that actor actually picks their own clothes. Mm-hmm. And you're like, oh, okay. So you might say, can I put in a request? Because red would be like a power thing here. And it'd be, yeah, you can, that may or may not happen. And so the same thing with equipment, you know,
okay.
Like you have a certain number of days with a crane on some shows. Some shows the crane's there all the time.
Mm-hmm.
I know now how long it takes to get a jib up, but on How to Get Away with Murder, they have the jib all the time. But because we were doing a split day with another episode,
we should explain that too. Jib, for instance, we should define a jib and then what a split day is for
yeah,
people.
Yeah, sure. So a jib is a piece of equipment where you could get like an overhead shot.
Mm-hmm.
And there are different types. I don't know all the types. I'm not as proficient as,
yeah, and
as
we don't need to be really.
Yeah, yeah. You know, it's my thing is I know what I want and I know what I want it to look like.
Yeah.
And so then it's just describing that to the DP. It's having that time and that relationship that
mm-hmm.
you can hopefully forge in an abbreviated period. And then saying, you know, this is what I want. Can we do that?
Yeah.
And then once they say, well, that's this and this, then I just start making notes. So on the next job, I'll be like, oh, do you have, you got a jib? What you got over there?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But so and then a split day is my episode is 5:13, but 5:14 started. So my last day was the first day for 5:14. So I got some crew members that went over to him, and then, you know, a bunch of stuff is shared, and he's on another soundstage, and we're both shooting at the same time.
Gotcha.
So if there's only one thing, then it's like if I put in an order, I would get it, or it's sitting out there, and whoever gets it first, depending on, you know, prep and if you said you wanted
it. Oh, yeah, it'd be devious.
So
just go out and get it.
Just go steal it. So I had not put in an order for it. I know we usually carried it, but I asked for a jib. But then it was about, this is the last scene, last setup.
Yeah.
I said, you know, how long is it going to take to get that up?
Yes.
And luckily we already had it. It was right there. And it, you know, took about 5 or 6 minutes. So then we put that up and we got the shot. But I'm a firm believer in collaborating and letting other people bring all that stuff to it.
Mm-hmm.
I would rather take the time with the material, with the intent, with the actors, with forging those relationships with my line producer and other people to try to make it than, and then doing my own writing, my own research and watching my own stuff than, you know, spending it with equipment.
Yes.
You know, and I take photos, I have some cameras, and usually now it's just all my iPhone, but I'm not doing that in my spare time. I'll say yet, just in case
that becomes
something I'm going to do.
Yeah, exactly.
So. Yeah.
I want to get to the point of when Sidney Lumet was directing this, he was really worried about making sure that he has final cut.
Mm.
And he was also very confident, though, that this would be a film after he had had a few successes and he had made enough money for people that he would have final cut, which is a good feeling for him. But it was also just like, if he doesn't have final cut, then he'll walk off. Like, he had gotten to that point in his career, and he did get it. But he said he didn't have final cut when he did The Pawnbroker, Stage Struck, The Appointment, and Love and Molly, and it drove him insane.
Wow. Yeah. Oh yeah, The Pawnbroker is so good. Yeah, I mean, I did not have final cut with either of my first two films.
Really?
No.
How do you feel about that?
Black and White Red All Over, yeah. Black and White Red All Over, yeah, it was just us. But Lift, no. You know, it becomes, you know, for me, indie filmmaking, it's sort of which works in concert, going back to something else with like two takes, because it's indie film, you know, it's indie filmmaking.
Indie film is TV at the same similar.
In terms of that, yeah. Like, okay, we've got it all set up here, but you only have time for two takes. So,
sure.
You know, it's that kind of thinking. And it's thinking of stuff like there's a scene in Lift where Niecy walks through her boyfriend's living room to get to the bedroom where she does a whole thing. It's a big, big turning point in the film. It's the end of the second act. And, you know, I think it was maybe a week before we shot that I was like, that's just a walkthrough. We don't need that. Like, all the money's in the bedroom, so let's cut that so we're not in that room.
Yeah.
What were we talking about? Sorry.
We were talking about Final Cut.
Yeah. So, oh, right. So, at the time, our producers, we had our editor, Peter Barstis, who is owns a shop called Edit Bar in Boston and does commercials and also does film, and he had cut Black and White and Red All Over. But they said, we think this needs to, like, go a step up and we want to bring in a new editor. And I was like, oh. And it was a weird thing where we're at, like, dinner at a really, like, I think we were at Pastis in New York. So I'm like, wow, this is, we're in the meatpacking district. It's fancy.
Yeah.
And then they lay it on us, you know, and I'm like, oh. But the good news is that we were still included and they still wanted input and they wanted us to sit with that editor. And that editor was Lee Percy, who, you know, did Reversal of Fortune, which won, for Jeremy Irons,
mm-hmm.
and did Boys Don't Cry. And so and he was great. And he did bring a different perspective. And sometimes it takes that outside person to come in and say, well, what if you tried this?
Yeah.
And sometimes that outside person can make you go, if you're open, which you should always be open, yeah, okay, let's try that. And especially with the equipment today, it takes a second. Now it's gone. Look at it.
Mm-hmm.
Very similar to working with Shoshana Tanzer on Queen Sugar. You know, we would get in there and she was like, I have ideas for cuts. And what do you have? And then we'd talk about them. And she goes, all right, I have an idea for a big cut. And I go, okay. And, you know, we would both like take a breath. And then she would say, you know, tell me. And I go, oh, I don't know. And she goes, why don't we try it? And then let's look at it later and see how we feel.
Yeah.
I'm like, great, which is why I love her. And so she would take it out. And then we do all this other stuff. And then at the end of the day, we look at it. And then she'd go, hey, what do you think about that big cut? And I was like, oh, I didn't even realize this. That's fine. I love it, you know?
Oh.
So, yeah. So, so I think what's most important is that you get your work out there. That's what you wanted, right? Like, for me, I wanted people to see my films because I wanted to give them sort of respite, some sort of place to go. I wanted them to know that they weren't alone in these different themes about materialism and motherhood with Lift, about violence with Black and White and Red All Over. And so you say to yourself, well, what am I going to do? Put my foot down to the point where no one sees this?
Mm-hmm.
That wasn't my goal. So, you know, you let it go. And then you just get excited about what's next, which is like, all right, this means a bunch more people are going to see it, or people are going to see it, period. Then that's great.
I mean, the key, it seems like to me, is just, you know, maybe Sidney Lumet was just getting his movies taken from him.
Maybe, yeah.
But, you know, as long as you're involved and collaborative in the process, then you're still getting your point of view. And obviously, I mean, in The Wiz, Diana Ross is a person who felt very important mm-hmm. on the set. And Sidney Lumet kind of let her have some kind of free reign of, you know, what she wanted. And she was the one who guaranteed that Michael Jackson would come on board. She's like, if I'm in, Michael will come. And they were like,
oh, fantastic.
You know, because Berry Gordy had bought the rights to the musical to make the film version. And so that was the thing that kind of put it over the top, where they were like, okay, if we can get Diana Ross and Michael Jackson. And then that kind of gave her ownership over the project in a very interesting way. Where,
yeah.
You know, she was working on the characters and working on the script. There was some contention because there was the fact that they put a lot of est principles into it, something that Diana Ross was studying, and I think Sidney Lumet had dabbled in. And est is, for people who watch The Americans,
watched it yet.
It is like a weird, it's like a kind of self-help, self-growth cult in a manner.
Mm-hmm.
But essentially, it's just like believing in yourself.
Yeah. Yeah. So, okay. So, a few things. First of all, I just got to give it up for Miss Ross, Diana Ross, who, looking back on this, like, Not only did she sing, not only were there lots of one takes, we're just sitting on her face. She's singing in a kitchen.
Yep.
She's singing, you know, to, you know, a tin man.
Yep.
Nipsey Russell, who people probably know who Nipsey Hussle is. I think he's a rapper, but yeah, that's from Nipsey Russell, who I used to watch on The Match Game.
He was so good on The Match Game.
I adored him. She danced her ass off. That's another thing that you see in these wides. There are no cuts. Like, how many takes of that where she is twirling and twirling and dancing around people and with people and touching them and singing?
In heels.
In heels, thank you, the entire time. So all hail, give it up for her on that. And that was a big difference for me than The Wizard of Oz, because although these sort of moral lessons were added, which weren't always there in The Wizard of Oz, it was all stuff that was like super important, you know, mm-hmm. like me being that age, like young teens, I was like, oh, this is great to hear black people talking about this. You know, like her saying to Michael Jackson, who's 20 years old at the time, Don't Stop Till You Get Enough had come out. You just need some self-confidence, you know, mm-hmm. like you can get up, like, I'll help you up. Can you get up? Let me help you up. Why don't you come with me? You know,
mm-hmm.
I hadn't seen or really heard that before, like in a yeah. giant spectacle like this. And that was helpful to me. I had no idea that it was asked. You know, believe is a word that I use a lot because I think towards the end of the movie, especially once you meet the Wiz, Richard Pryor, and you see that he's like this sad man in a bathrobe who's alone, who, you know, basically made them go kill the bad witch
mm-hmm.
because he, you know, she might have killed him because he has no power. And then he's all alone. And then he's like, well, no, can you just stay with me? You can even like yell at me and call me names if you want. I'm just so lonely, which is like very interesting. Who does that sound like that? Someone who's alone in a house who really thought they had all the power, playing like you got power, but you got no power, making other people do your bidding. We have the power. Let me just jump off that for a minute. I thought that was really interesting, too, because what that means to me at the end is that we are the wizards.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So he says to her at the end, once like Lena Horne comes, and another little thing that's different, Glinda in The Wizard of Oz says, you know, you had the power to go home all the time. Now click your heels and say there's no place like home. Lena Horne doesn't say that. She just says you had the power to go home all the time, you know, and I think she says something about clicking your heels, but she doesn't like wave a wand. And when Dorothy says, so now once she's like, she's fully awake, right?
Yeah.
Then Richard Pryor is like,
can you do something for me?
They've had what they've been searching for in them all along. I don't know what's in you. You'll have to find that out for yourself.
And I was like, oh, snap.
That, right? Yeah, that was the shocking one where she's just like, you need to help yourself.
You help yourself, right?
Mm-hmm.
But that's it. We are our biggest champion and our biggest villain. We have to help ourselves. We have to figure it out. We have to go deep so that we don't live in a giant head with the afro, which I love, that shoots fire,
mm-hmm.
that intimidates people and says, now the color is red. Now the color is green. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
We have to work that out so we don't work it out through other people. We work on ourselves and then we're good, you know? And then Glinda's like, she's like, okay, I'm ready to go now. And she was like, you can go whenever you want, yo. And it's like, boom. And then, you know, of course, like the effects are, you know, whatever, because it's back in that time. But this wasn't even an effect. It's just a straight cut. Now it's like you're looking at feet.
Yeah, it was a straight cut. You're right.
Right? And then she's in the feet in the snow. And then she runs home and it's the end of Big. R.I.P. Penny Marshall, I love you. When he runs in the house and he's got the long,
mm-hmm.
you know what I mean? Same thing. You just stay outside. You never even go back in. You just know that she's going to be okay because she went from this meek person who maybe didn't know herself as well and couldn't find her own voice. And mind you, it was interesting to also see, like, she was doing the cleaning, the cooking. She's running around in the very beginning.
Mm-hmm.
She's like, you know, no opinion. And then very, you know, sort of like mother. Well, oh, how about Ron? He's very, she's like, I'm not thinking about Ron. And I just want to teach the children. And now she goes from that to she has this big voice. She's led everyone. She's found what's important in herself. She's found herself. And then she's home. And also Lena Horne saying, home is, it's when you find yourself, and then it's wherever you are.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's not a physical, material thing. And that's about being comfortable, Like, that's you know, and, you know, listen, when we get comfortable, that's when we're really dangerous. Because we got nothing to lose. And I will tell you, having done this for a little bit, and again, I thank you, Ava, so much. I get comfortable on those sets now where I'm like, it's clicking. I don't second guess myself. I know what I want. I'm telling people. And that's when I can step back from myself and go, ooh, yeah. Every woman needs to feel that and mm-hmm. to know that. And then it's a wrap.
We're going to take another quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk about shooting on locations, and we're going to talk about handling some budgets, because there's some stories with this. So one quick break.
Hello, this is Amy Mann.
And I'm Ted Leo.
And we have a podcast called The Art of Process. We're talking about how the creative process is in itself an art form, in our opinion. There are underlying forms and structures that serve as a scaffolding for any creative endeavor.
We've been lucky enough over the past year to talk to some of our friends and acquaintances from across the creative spectrum to find out how they actually work.
We weirdly don't know as many musicians as you would expect.
New episodes will be coming every other Monday,
starting January 28th.
So please listen and subscribe at MaximumFun.org or wherever you get your podcast.
Welcome back to Switchblade Sisters. I'm April Wolf, and I'm joined today by Demaine Davis, and we are talking about The Wiz. Okay, so you mentioned earlier this is New York. Not New York, sometimes New York, very realistic place, sometimes fantasy, sometimes on a sound stage. So, you know, let's just talk about what that means and how that adds to this film, or, you know, your experience of shooting on sets and stuff. Because I know Diana Ross was the one who really fought to have this film in New York.
It's so dope.
She fought, and, you know, you're talking about empowering someone and having, you know, that kind of influence on the process. Mm-hmm. And she got her way, which meant that they revived essentially the Kaufman Astoria Studios, which after The Wiz became a very popular studio for people to shoot in, and also revived the whole film industry in a sense in New York at the time when, you know, people were heading to LA or, mm-hmm. you know, doing films outside of the city. So that was a really big thing at that time. And, you know, obviously we've seen so many very popular shows and movies get filmed in Kaufman Astoria until I think it's shut down now, right?
I don't know.
I think maybe it's closed. Could be wrong. But I find that fascinating. And I find the things that they chose to construct and the things that they chose to use. You know, Emerald City is World Trade Center.
I know.
Right?
That was tough to see when they panned up.
It's insane.
It's really like chills. I got chills.
Yeah. You have all these people and they're, you know, it's joyous dancing there. Mm-hmm. And it's such a strange thing. I do have to say that the filming of that scene, they didn't get to do all the takes that they wanted because the wind was incredible at that time. So they were outside.
Yeah.
With the elements, there's, you know, nothing to protect them. And they, you know, they wanted to get that pan up. They wanted to get the sense of space that, you know, like this is a really magical place, you mm-hmm. know, like this exists in real life. This is all around you. Mm-hmm. But I thought that was an incredible choice. And alternatively, you know, the New York Public Library, they had to construct inside because, you know, they couldn't lock off that entire part of the street to show the facade of the building. So, you know, they had to be very delicate with what they chose. They definitely filmed in Coney Island. Mm-hmm. It's fantastic what they were able to do.
It's absolutely fantastic. And definitely added to just that, the grandness of it being a real place and possibly existing. I want to throw in that when the taxi's driving away from her, I know that I lived in New York for a little while, but before I moved there, I sort of had this fear of New York. And mm-hmm. I think that was embedded. I'm like, I'm never going to catch a taxi because they always just run. They went away from Dorothy. So, it's not true. It's super easy to catch a cab there. Also, the streets being numbered is really helpful. I don't think people wanted me to move there. But when she helps the scarecrow up. And after all the other crows are like, you can't win, and that whole thing.
Yeah.
And then he looks up and he starts to see the bricks. And then they see that, you know, that bridge. And obviously that's a backdrop, but mm-hmm. still, like, you believe. And it's like five Empire State Buildings with this roller coaster mm-hmm. thing kind of going through it. It sets the stage so well, that and then the playground for believing, mm-hmm. truly for believing and feeling like it's a real place. And like I said, that awe scene and seeing those people, like, you can see the wind blowing, and I realized, like, whoa, it's really cold out there.
Yeah, they are freezing right? their asses off.
It's really cold, but, like, so that's a testament to them and mm-hmm. making it, but that can also truly put you in a place where, for instance, on Queen Sugar, we filmed on a real sugarcane farm. Mm-hmm. It's a totally different look, feel, like that heat, like when Kofi sweats, who plays Ralph Angel, like he's really sweating. You know what I mean? When, mm-hmm. like, Dondre Whitfield, who plays Remy, is out there and, you know, he takes his hat off and wipes his brow, like that's real. Cause, you know, there's black ants and fire ants and armadillos and snakes out there mm-hmm. and it's, you know, 80 degrees. So it not only does something texturally to the colors and that feeling, it does something to the actors mm-hmm. who have this burden of pretending that it's a real place. So I'm all in for what Diana Ross did and having it done in New York, because then it's like nothing else.
Yeah. You know, earlier you were talking about how she was dancing, and there was like mm-hmm. a scene where she's going over the bridge in the yellow brick into Coney Island. And I'm like, oh, girl, you're going to break your ankle.
Right.
Like,
right.
I thought she was going to tumble, but it was just, you know.
Yeah. And that's one take.
Yeah.
That's one take. And like, she fell down a bunch of times. I'm yeah. like, that's her.
Yeah.
Like, there's no, and I don't see any padding.
No.
Like, she went for it.
Yeah.
And that first, when they first sing the first Ease On Down the Road, which is like, if you cannot snap your fingers or sing it or bop something inside you, a light has gone out. So investigate that, because that song is like so incredible. That's just one take. They're just spinning. He's doing his like patented, like Michael Jackson spins at mm-hmm. 20 years old. They grab hands. They get it on the beat. Toto's there. But, you know, whatever with Toto, because like he's the one who ran out of the house who made her. I guess it's fine in the end because she
you're
ran out of the house.
And
she
Toto in the end.
I guess. But I'm like, Toto, you're such a dick. Like, the door opened and he just runs out. You never did that before. But on the snowstorm, you know, Toto. Like, so, yeah, like it's so real visually. It's so stunning. And what she did, I mean, she committed, you know, I adore actors for what they do and where they go, you know,
yeah.
And she went there. It was great to rewatch and be like, oh, my God, she's crying and she's singing and she's dancing. What is happening?
No. And she's she did end up getting hospitalized for like 2 days.
She did?
Yeah. She got blinded by a laser light. And
what?
They had to, and her sister had to fill in to do some body double stuff.
Oh my God!
Just for like the few days that she was out, so they would film kind of like larger things because.
Oh wow! I didn't
whatever
know that.
You know she could pass for, but yeah, she went to the hospital and came back, and you know she was a trooper. But that's something that you get from someone you know like Michael Jackson and like Diana Ross, who had to come up singing. You know, mm-hmm. on stage and records and like had to do it perfect, had to like perform. And, you know, you don't get cuts. You don't get to have
no.
like a second take when
no.
you're doing a stage show. There's
nope.
You know, like that's just not something that happens.
No.
So.
Beyonce fell down those steps and popped back up.
And it
that's
was
like
beautiful.
That
you're like, that's part
yeah.
of the dance.
You're
you
like,
know?
Oh, I'm going to fall down and pop up now. That's the new dance. I'm going to call that the Beyonce. also, that it was sort of reminiscent of 28 Days Later. To have like just like an empty city when she was first there
yeah.
and walking through it,
yeah.
you know, which would at first lead you to believe, well, that's got to be a set because how did you get
yeah.
New York empty like that? But it's not.
And also, you know, New York at that time was a very different New York.
Yeah, that's true.
And it's, you know, kind of a time capsule of,
yeah.
you know, like a pre, you know, like very, very pre Rudy Giuliani kind of New York, you
yeah.
know, like this very, like a dirtier and kind of lively
mm-hmm.
city.
Mm-hmm.
And I think one of the things that I was kind of disappointed to see when I was reading about Diana Ross was that she wasn't actually even all that impressed with her performance in this movie.
She wasn't?
No, I think she said that the only time that she was ever able to watch something that she did and feel like she wasn't just watching Diana Ross, you know, like that she was watching someone else, was mm-hmm. Lady Sings the Blues.
Okay, because she was playing a character.
Yeah, and yeah, so yeah. She felt like, even with The Wiz, she wasn't really impressed with her performance.
Wow, that's unfortunate.
I mean, it's high standards, though.
Yeah, well, that's every... I know that Kofi Cirabo, who plays Ralph Angel on Queen Sugar, he never watches a show. He never
really?
Watches himself, yep. And having just worked with Miss Viola Davis, she says that she doesn't watch herself. And I wanted to ask her about sort of what you're talking about. Like, is there a feeling that you feel when you know you gave a performance and you nailed it? Or are you completely out of your body? And yeah. Does it turn into something else? But this was like in between takes. And once she said she didn't watch, I was kind of like, okay, and we were just getting ready to set something else up. But, you know, yeah, there are a lot of people who don't watch for whatever reason, but mm-hmm. we watch. So
yeah,
that's all that matters.
We're like, always watching.
Listen, I'm grateful. I'm getting all the benefits.
How do you feel about this being, I mean, at the time, this was the biggest budget musical yeah. film ever made.
Mm-hmm.
And it was spent on a black cast,
yep.
which is phenomenal to me.
Huge.
The fact that like that's something that they spent the most money on a musical with a all black cast.
I know.
That doesn't make a lot of sense to me in terms of like the way that film went after that, you mm-hmm. know, it wasn't like they went and spent a bunch of money on anything else, but mm-hmm. you know, at least it was one watermark, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And that's what you need to have a second one. So I think a lot of times, at least the way it used to be, is a film would come out and this is a black film, and then some people would get mad about it because it didn't address this theme or this theme or this theme.
Mm-hmm.
And that's because there's so little black film. And so we're looking for this one film to have all of our hopes and dreams and go into and talk about all these different issues because there might not be another one.
Sure.
And now we're finally in a place where it's like you can have a Black Klansman and you can have Dope, which was a dope movie. And you know, you can have Black Panther and the amazing the Spider-Verse movie was fucking so
That's
fucking
great.
Good. You've seen it, right?
Yeah.
Oh my God, I got to see that again. So I think, you know, back then, first of all, I think it was easier to do because it was a successful Broadway show.
Yeah. And all you have to do is 1,600 performances of the same show and then they'll give you some money. Weird.
Yeah. Okay. And then, of course, once you get Diana Ross, it's another thing, right? Her coming hot off of those two films in the
yep.
last few years, and then her bringing in Michael Jackson, like, okay, this is a...
Yeah, Universal said it was
wrap.
A done deal as soon as Michael Jackson
sure.
and Diana Ross signed on.
Yeah, yeah. So, and then, you know, John Badham, it's the same thing as not getting Final Cut. He's like, no, I'm gonna fall on my sword over Stephanie Mills.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, you have to make that decision. Well, what's more important? Do I want to make this and get this out there with this universal truth, or do I want to commit to this, you know, particular actor?
I don't understand. I mean, I look back on this. Of course, we do on all cult films, and I don't understand why it wasn't a success, but it was a flop.
Mm, yeah, I don't either.
Perhaps it was marketing. Perhaps it was something else. But
maybe
I don't think we'll ever know like the full circumstances of you know why it wasn't seen in theaters. But I'm happy to know that it's being revived, and now through our episode, more people can find it.
Yeah, yeah. I want to just talk very briefly. Two things. Well, this is like six things, but these are the lessons that I found in it, and especially mm-hmm. in rewatching it. So be adventurous, find courage, get out of your comfort zone. Super important, find your tribe
mm-hmm.
to take that journey with you. You know, there will be challenges, but you're gonna grow. You know, there might be crows that bully you in your life, but you can get beyond them, especially when you have allies. There might be marionettes in the subway, which is petrifying to me, and they start growing.
It's
and then
scary.
Like, it's so scary. I had to go to bed after watching that. I was like, this is awful. And the columns might close in on you,
mm-hmm.
but someone, you know, you have your tribe, grow your self-confidence. Someone will help you. Help someone up when they're down. which is like literal. That's what she did. You know, believe. And then, you know, don't carry nothing that might be a load. Ease on down that road, dude.
That's a perfect way to end it. Ease on down that road. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Is there anything coming up where we can see your work, stuff that we should see that you're doing?
I would tell everyone to go download or get to a theater. Well, it's only going to be in a theater for a week, but you can now order on iTunes Egg. It has Christina Hendricks in it and Lisa Reiner from Fig from Orange is the New Black as a producer, and she also stars in it and produced the movie with her husband, David Bastian. It was written by my very good friend, Risa Mickenberg. It's a great film. And then my episode of For the People should air sometime in April. The new season starts March 7th. The Red Line from CBS is coming out April 28th. I did the 7th episode of that. And then my episode of How to Get Away with Murder, which I still can't believe I get to say that, will air on Valentine's Day.
Ooh, you got a date.
I got a date, yo.
Thank you for listening to Switchblade Sisters. I want to take a minute to thank some of our listeners who were so generous and sent us some cards and some gifts, including some awesome soap and a really killer sci-fi book and just some really meaningful, thoughtful words that honestly made me cry. All of you are so appreciated and we love you. And whoever you are who sent us the soap and the book, tweeted us so that we know who you are, because I can't read the name. And I know that you, I think you also sent some earrings too that I wear all the time, and I just want to make sure that I can thank you properly. If you like what you're hearing, you don't have to send us gifts, but please leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. If you do, we'll read it on air. There's no new reviews this week, so please, please do us a favor and tell one of your friends about our show. If you love the show, your friend will probably love it too. Your friend deserves to know about Switchblade Sisters. Do not keep it a secret. And then, if you have time, go write us a 5-star review on iTunes. If you want to let us know what you think of the show, you can tweet us at Switchblade Pod or email us at SwitchbladeSisters@MaximumFun.org. Please check out our Facebook group. That's Facebook.com/groups/SwitchbladeSisters. Our producer is Casey O'Brien. Our senior producer is Laura Swisher. And this is a production of MaximumFun.org.
We just want to lay a little thanks on you.
What? You know, heavy on the gratitude department.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Listener supported.